Hey, thanks for listening to another episode of Law for Software Engineers. My name is Michael Rice. I'm a lawyer here in California, but I'm actually more of a software engineer than a lawyer. It's confusing, I know. Why don't you just call me Engineering Counsel? This is one of three things I'm trying to do, this podcast, is to bring together a discussion of law and software engineering topics. I don't think this is attorney advertising, but maybe it actually is. Anytime a lawyer puts something out there, it might be construed as such. So in any event, I don't think it's going to sound much like an ad to you. Anyway, what I was trying to say is that I want to spark a conversation around law and software engineering. And there are three ways that I'm trying to do it. First is this podcast, so thanks for listening. Second, I'm publishing an almost daily newsletter at engineeringcounsel.substack.com. I'm going to start charging for it eventually because it's actually going to be that valuable. Finally, I run a meetup in the LA area where we do a weekly conference call on law and software engineering called the Software Engineers Legal Meetup. Clever, I know. The goal is also to host some in-person meetups, such as one we did in Venice a few weeks ago, which I thought was super cool. You are totally welcome to join the call. Just drop me an email. There'll be a link in the show notes, and I'll give you the Zoom. We meet most Wednesdays at noon on Los Angeles time over Zoom. What you're going to hear in this episode is a recording from our very first conference call on July 3rd, 2019. I'm sorry for the audio quality. I'd love to blame Zoom, but I can't. I was really inconsistent about where I held the microphone, so sometimes it gets a little quiet. Don't even bother turning it up because it gets louder pretty quickly thereafter. So anyway, no more chit-chat. Let's jump into the recording. All right, so we have one person on the call. No big deal. I'll explain in a second. Just so you know, I am recording this. My goal is to get this posted for folks to be able to listen to. Believe it or not, I have other meetup groups where I've done a similar conference call, and it works pretty well to have the recording. It's interesting. Maybe like you'll get a lot more listens on the recording than the real event. This is the Law and Software Engineers Legal Meetup, Law and Software Engineering Conference Call. My goal is to do this every week. This is our very first one. We've got a very, very small show up, which is no surprise. We've only got about 47 people on the meetup group, which is actually seven more than we started the week with. So we picked up quite a few members just to think through having this event scheduled. And that is kind of how the meetup game works. So I've organized a number of meetups. I've grown some to be very large. The way you start is you just have to keep having meetups. And I don't think the algorithm's quite as punishing as, like, say, the Facebook or LinkedIn or Twitter algorithms in terms of engagement. But I think meetup definitely doesn't start recommending groups until you hit a certain critical mass. But the only way you can get a critical mass is by having more meetup groups, or meetup events. So that's exactly what we're doing. This conference call is kind of a way to trick out the algorithm, at least in my mind. But it's also kind of a convenient thing because in LA, it's hard to get people together. But that said, we do have a happy hour scheduled for next week. I think it's next Wednesday down in the South Bay where I am. We had our first happy hour, was it last week or the week before, up in Santa Monica, where we had a number of people show up, which was fantastic. Some people drove pretty far, so that was pretty cool. My name is Michael Rice. I am mostly a software engineer. I've been writing code for 20 years. Or so. Today I'm kind of an individual contributor writing a lot of code for the blockchain of all things. But I also am, along the way, I picked up a law degree and a license to practice law here in California. And actually the work I do today is, my official title is legal engineer. So I do a lot of legal work combining legal analysis with blockchain code, which is pretty cool. A lot of people talk, there's a lot of hype around blockchain, or there was. But it's cool to actually be working for a company that's really doing it. This call, we're going to have to kind of hustle through the content because we only have about 30 to 40 minutes because I'm on the free Zoom. I guess if we start getting enough people, I'll cough up $20 a month or whatever for Zoom. This group, let's talk a little bit about the mission of the group. It's for law and software engineering. And the idea behind it is to take some of the FUD, right? The FUD, the fear, uncertainty, and doubt around code and legal issues, kind of out of the system, right? I mean, there's lots of confusing issues, things like copyright. Can I do this? Can I do that? Oh, we got a helpful comment in the chat. I'll get back to that in a second. Can I do this? Can I do that? Does this open source license cover that? There can be a lot of confusion there. Lots you can Google, but doesn't necessarily clear up the FUD. There are, of course, privacy issues, HIPAA privacy, people running around saying, oh, you can't do that because of HIPAA regulations. And maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. There's probably not a lawyer telling you that. It's probably somebody else that read some interpretation. So lots of confusion all over the place. I mean, even if you're writing code using Microsoft's VS Code or Apple's Xcode or stuff that, you know, the stuff you're writing is actually kind of regulated a bit by private contract, right? All kinds of interesting issues that we can explore, even like employment issues. You know, can your employer really do X, right? And what if you're got a side project going? All kinds of interesting stuff. So the agenda for this call is to basically do that intro that I just did. Nobody has to speak up on the call. You can do listen only if on the calls. If you want to speak up, you're more than welcome to, but you don't have to. Next, we'll do two things. We'll first talk about some a little bit of legal news or you know, some like kind of interesting updates that came out of, you know, either the case law or the legal or the tech press or whatever that might touch on software engineering and law. And then we'll do something really brief about like some substantive area of law. So something like, we'll probably just kind of rotate around. So this week we'll do intellectual property just because that's such a, you know, an obvious one to hit. But things like privacy, there's a huge new privacy bill coming in California. Lots and lots of issues we can talk about. So let's talk about the news. For me, one of the biggest news items that's out there is iOS 13, which has nothing to do with legal issues, but I can't wait to get my hands on it. I'm not aggressive enough that I want to put the developer stuff on my phone or my my desktop yet, but looking forward to it. And I mention it because, you know, eventually we should cover some of the Apple developer terms of use and stuff. I know there's a few lockups in terms of what you can say and can't say about it, but we'll try to figure out what we can talk about because I think it's super interesting. But also there's something that came out a month ago now or so, and it's a case called Apple v. Pepper. And I think developers will be very interested in this one. This one is basically, I won't go through the details too much, but basically there's a class action suit. There's a number of them actually against Apple with some complaints about the way the App Store is structured. So as you know, if you're an Apple developer, you or an iOS developer, to get anything on a device, you got to go through the App Store. And the App Store has its terms of use, and it's the only App Store, and they charge a pretty hefty commission or whatever they call it when they sell your software or transact it. So there was a lawsuit that started, I think back in 2011, or maybe, I don't know, maybe I can't remember when it started. Maybe it was earlier than that. But it actually went the case wound its way all the way up to the Supreme Court. Now, the Supreme Court recently ruled against Apple, but it doesn't mean it was a very narrow ruling in that it was on a very technical procedural ground. So we still don't know really what's going to happen to the App Store yet. There will still be quite a bit of litigation, quite a bit of time before we know what happens. But effectively, the Supreme Court ruled that the suit can go forward. There had been some litigation around whether purchasers of Apple or apps through the App Store had standing to sue. And it actually kind of, I think, you know, there's been a lot of writing in the legal academy about whether it was a good ruling or not. Lawyers will disagree, of course. Hey, we've got a few new joiners, so thanks for joining. As I mentioned to the folks, where I mentioned early in the call, you don't have to participate at all. You can just listen in if you want. And we are recording this. So if you do say anything, just know that you were recording. And the idea behind the recording is we can share it with our meetup community later. So anyway, with the App Store, let me see, there's a quick comment here. Let's take a peek. Yeah, I will. The question is, can you share some links? And the answer is, of course, I will do that. I'll send a follow-up email with this record, link to this recording, and then whatever else I can find. So anyway, Apple v. Pepper, the narrow issue is whether if you're the buyer of an app, can you really sue Apple? Because you're kind of a third party. The argument was that you're like a third party to the deal, and really the people who should be suing Apple, and this is just kind of my high level summary, are the app developers, not the the consumers. But it's kind of ridiculous because really, like, if you, I'm sorry, excuse me, I shouldn't use my, my editorial ridiculous, but I think it's kind of a strange way of thinking about it, in the sense that if you're buying stuff, you're buying it directly from the app store, right? I mean, it's like, the third party analysis seems kind of odd on the facts anyway, but hey, it got all the way to the Supreme Court. So there was something very serious, something really there. So we will stay tuned to Apple v. Pepper. The upshot of it is if the plaintiffs win big or make, you know, significant advances against Apple in the litigation, you know, you might see something like, it's hard to imagine Apple actually opening up so anybody can build their own app store. But maybe the commissions will come down, or maybe there'll be some concessions. So definitely something that I think developers will be very interested in coming up. There's two more things I want to cover in our kind of newsy section of the agenda. The other one isn't legal yet, but I think it's an interesting issue. So as you know, Boeing has an airplane that's been grounded for some time now, the 737 MAX. It was pretty tragic what happened to, I believe it was two flights that crashed. And part of it was due to the design of the airplane and kind of the, I guess you could call it the user experience for the pilots, and some confusion about training and stuff. I mean, there's lots to it, lots more than I know about avionics, obviously. But, you know, some of it had to do with the software too. And one of the things that came out in the news just recently was that Boeing had, I went to law school in Seattle. So, and Boeing was like literally in my backyard because I lived close to Renton. Before they moved to Chicago, or right around the time they moved to Chicago. But the Boeing engineers were complaining, the software engineers were complaining, because they had outsourced quite a bit of the development to offshore companies. And the report that came out was that they were paying as low as like $9 an hour, even $5 an hour for developers. And I mean, anybody that's been in the business for a while, especially with big companies, you know that this offshoring and outsourcing happens. But, you know, I think given the context of what happened and some of the negative, you know, connotations that this creates, you can imagine it at least raises the eyebrows of regulators in DC and stuff. So nothing really specific legal there, but, you know, it's kind of like some of these decisions we make create like reputational risk. So something to think about. Finally, I want to review something that came out of case law. So there's always interesting cases coming out of the courts, right? And a lot of these things are not necessarily making new law. In fact, most of them don't. But some of them involve software engineers. So this is one, or software developers. And this is one I thought was really interesting. It was out of upstate New York. It doesn't really change the law for anybody, but it's an interesting case that I thought you'd like to hear about. So it was Fernandez versus Abatayo, or maybe reverse, Abatayo versus Fernandez, I can't remember. So Fernandez was an optometrist, so he's not a developer, and he wanted to create a website back in 2011. And I guess maybe it was some kind of e-commerce type site, or maybe he could create custom glasses or something. And he hired Mr. Abatayo to build it. So they started working on it, and you got to listen closely to the facts on this one. He started working on it June 20th, 2011, and the optometrist was paying him $439 per week to work on. Abatayo promised that the site would be active and operational. And so a few months later, on October 29th, they further agreed that the $439 per week would actually be deducted from a future share of the revenues from the site. So Abatayo was going to get a revenue interest in this product, about 10%. So they must have, like, maybe that was like a new thing. And then they also entered another agreement where Fernandez said he would give the developer $10,000 in advance on the 10% revenue, I guess, if the site was online by February 2012. But come February, sometime in February, the site still wasn't done. And so the optometrist stopped paying him, hired another web developer for $24,000 flat, I guess, and then sued the web developer, Mr. Abataya. So I guess the theory was breach of contract. So he said, hey, you know, you promised me a website. I never got one. And the trial court in New York actually agreed that Abataya had breached his contract because the site was never launched, apparently. I didn't read the lower court order. So the optometrist got a judgment against him for exactly $56,586.97 plus costs. So like all kinds of other little fees that come with it. Interestingly, Abataya appealed. And he actually got the judgment reversed. And so this is kind of interesting. So the case I'm reading you actually came out of the appellate court in New York. The appeals court said, the party's agreement only said that he would work on the website, unquote. And two, at trial, the plaintiff didn't prove that the website wasn't done within a reasonable time, even though he promised to get it done eventually. So you're probably saying to yourself, but he promised to get a working website, right? But according to the terms of the agreement, I guess there was no deadline in the contract, and whether it was taking an unreasonable amount of time. I mean, I think that's a pretty long period of time. That's what we're talking about here. We're going from June to October, assuming it's just kind of a straight e-commerce site. That's quite a bit of time, right? So, but the trick is nobody ever, the appellate court can't decide whether that's reasonable or unreasonable. That would have had to be determined at trial, and it wasn't. So trial counsel, I don't want to say made a mistake, but just didn't make a record of that. And therefore it was easy to reverse it on appeal. So there you go. Our web developer, Mr. Abataya, beat the judgment. But then again, I wonder how much he had to pay his lawyer to go through trial and then appeals. It was probably not an insignificant amount of money, but maybe, I don't know, maybe less than 56,000. So I thought that was an interesting story. I'll try to find more like that for next week. There's another one that's, I think, kind of interesting that I was looking at. It's a little long, but it's a divorce case of all things. And it's a developer who had an interest in a company that he started, and then kind of how that sorted out, or how that worked out when he like focused on development instead of managing the company. So I guess I'll pause there and see if there's any questions or any comments. But like I said, no pressure. If you guys don't want to talk, you don't have to.
So, Michael, this is Victor.
Hey, Victor.
Quick question.
Yeah.
In any way, I think, does the problem/issue lies under the contractual, or do you still see this as a cyber legal issue? Which category does this fall under? Contractual issue or cyber law issue?
Yeah. So I think in this case, it was just a straight contract issue. So like a breach of contract complaint.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, but I think it's kind of interesting. It's like, I'm just kind of looking for anything where like the two Venn diagram of like law and software engineers and where they, so, you know, we could do any contract. It's probably similar to almost any contract, breach of contract case, but I thought it was interesting because it was like specifically for.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think it's just abstraction right now, how you read that contract, because it's technical jibber jabber. So how you read it and interpret it in legal terms, I think then it will become contractual or promissory or estoppel or something like that.
Yeah. There could have been any number of complaints, like maybe like unjust enrichment, right? Like the developer is just getting money and not doing anything, you know, right? There were any number of claims that we could have like analyzed. And like I said, I only had the really short appellate decision, and it was like only like two pages, and it just kind of explained like, hey, you know, they agreed to pay. It's coming kind of like if you had agreed to have somebody come to your house and start painting the house, right?
Yeah.
You're like, hey, I'll pay you $400 a week to paint the house. And they keep working and they keep working, right? And they're painting.
Exactly.
Right. So, but I mean, the contract explicitly said he would get it done, right? But it just didn't say when.
And when,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, what happens if you don't have those that specific deadline is the court will then have to say, well, is he like taking an unreasonably long amount of time to do that? And they just never reached that at trial, I guess. So there was never a fine. The trial court never said, well, you know, obviously getting it done within a reasonable amount of time should be implied in the contract, kind of like a good faith thing, right? And I guess they just never reached that. So
here's the tricky part. So I mean, you know, in general terms, we know the reasonable time or reasonable person. It's kind of tricky, and you need to interpret, and you know, your attorneys has to argue in court. But when it comes to these legal terms, how does this work out reasonable? Because creating a website could take 8 hours, or creating a website could take 8 months. So
yep.
There's no set fine line of documentation that what a website should take that much time. So I think that's interesting to see how this is going to play out in real world.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. So, but the way this works is the reason Abbatio won on appeal is because of the way the way procedural and appellate law works. So because, remember there were two cases. So I'm giving you the second one, the appellate case. In the trial court, what they would have had to do to avoid this result on appeal is they would have had to have the judge actually make a finding or the jury or whoever that, like, hey, you know, given the, for all the stuff they wanted to do on the website and for all the, you know, delays, and I'm sure the optometrist was making changes as they were going, right? Lots of little change orders and scope changes and shifts around. And, the trial judge would have had to say, yeah, you know, this should have been done. It was unreasonable that it was taking this long. And that's one of my factual determinations. But because that factual determination was never entered, as far as I know, that's what the appeal court said is like, hey, you know, didn't say no, the trial court didn't tell us that it took an unreasonable amount of time. So we're just going to reverse because the appellate court isn't going to make that kind of determination. So kind of tricky procedural appellate procedure stuff, but we're standard yeah. review, but it's
but pretty interesting. I'm pleased to see this is catching up in legal world as well. And kind of, you know, we have specialized cyber law attorneys these days, kind of they specialize in these world and they interpret the law for judges because sometimes I mean, judges struggle with how to read this and understand in general terms because law was never established for these wires and packets and bits and bytes.
Yep, yep. Or scope changes or how long does it take to build a website or anything like that.
Exactly.
Yep. Cool. Well, thanks for commenting. Let's move on. So I was mentioning we only have about 30 to 40 minutes before Zoom will cut me off, but let's do one thing. I wanted to leave you with something that's sort of useful. And we'll go through different substantive areas of law each week. So this week, intellectual property is kind of an obvious choice just because it's like something that is really prominent in the tech world. So let's talk really loosely about intellectual property is. Intellectual property is not really one law. It's a whole bunch of different laws. And the way that it was described to me in law school was like a bundle of sticks, right? So if you imagine a bundle, you take a stick, a whole bunch of little sticks you find, wrap them up and bundle them up. That's intellectual property law. Each stick has a different use, a different kind of size and shape and stuff, but they all kind of have one general concept in that they're trying to exclude others from using things you have. So intellectual property is kind of interesting because, especially I think for software developers, because in the new world of open source, where almost everything a developer needs is pretty much free, it seems like things like copyrights, trademarks, and especially patents, right? Software patents are kind of anachronistic to the developer ethos. But it's kind of interesting because actually intellectual property is what enables those things to be free. So I used to work at Red Hat, like the ultimate open source company, and the reason those open source licenses work is because of the license grant. We actually are granting them to be free, but we put certain strings on it so that it stays free. And it's copyright law, interestingly, kind of being used against itself, and that's what they call it, copyleft. That's like a huge topic we could spend a ton of time on. If we were to just donate code to the public domain, we lose that ability. So it's kind of interesting. Also, even things like being able to license the use of software or like our software, you know, SaaS applications, those licenses depend a lot on copyright and intellectual property law. Let's see. There's really like three kind of big areas, maybe four big areas of intellectual property law that you've probably heard of: copyright, trademark, and patent law. These are all federal laws, so they come from federal statutory schemes. And then the fourth one is trade secret, which is actually more of a state law system. I think there's actually some interest in making it a federal law, but generally you probably know this, copyright covers works of authorship and authors automatically get a collection of rights. So again, more sticks within the bundle when they fix work into some kind of tangible medium. So as a software engineer, you presumptively get rights, which are probably, you've probably already, you get rights in your code as you write it, but the, you've probably already assigned them away to your employer. So, so that's another area that we'll definitely get into is, works for hire and things you do on the job. You probably, you know, either impliedly gave them to your employer or you, you did it by like specific, like by a written contract. Like I said, copyright, like patent and trademark is a federal law. Congress is the body that defines it and kind of creates its what we call meets and bounds, its parameters. And actually the right of Congress to do that is actually spelled out specifically in the Constitution, which is pretty interesting. It's not like some of the more obscure congressional powers like the Dormant Commerce Clause that if you went to law school, you would have had nightmares over that one. There's a lot of nuance to copyright law, but generally the idea is that you get an exclusive right for 70 years to, and this is the interesting part. So to one, reproduce, two, create derivative works, three, distribute the work, four, publicly perform it, five, publicly display it, and six, digitally transmit sound recordings. So it's like this like real specific thing about sound recordings. So copyright law isn't just like one thing. It's like a whole bunch of different exclusions that you get rights in. And obviously copyright is what really powers Hollywood here in LA. And you know, like I said, it's super important in software. Let's turn to patent law real quickly. Patent law is very different in that you don't get automatic patent protection. So in copyright law, generally you prevent people from copying something you've authored. But in patent law, you get a much more abstract right. You get the right to exclude others from using one of your inventions, like no matter what form it is. So it's like, you can't really patent ideas, but like if you come up with an idea for building something, like I'm looking at my kid's trampoline right now, if I had come up with a better kind of trampoline, I don't actually have to build it to get protection in it, but I do have to go prosecute a patent, which is pretty expensive and pretty complicated. And of course, patents in software are a very hot topic. I actually did some work while I was in law school learning how to patent or prosecute software patents, and it is like super, super complex. But the idea behind it is kind of a good one. It was a good innovation a couple hundred years ago. And the idea is that we wanted to incentivize inventors to disclose their inventions, and right? So instead of keeping it secret, so everybody can learn from what the inventions are. And in return for that disclosure, we would give them an exclusive right to use those inventions for a certain period of time. I think that works pretty well in the pharmaceutical world, but in the software world, especially in the land where we're doing almost everything open source and in GitHub, and things are being disclosed already, it's arguable whether it's really useful for the software world. And obviously there's a lot of backlash there. The other topic at the federal level is trademark. This is also very important and probably very useful even for open source projects that are highly branded. I mean, you notice some of the really good ones, things like Docker. I mean, they actually built a whole company around Docker, but even in its early days, it's got the whale and the cargo ship and it's got all these kind of things that make it really clear that this code comes from Docker. And, you know, there's a lot of value in knowing that the code comes from the source, right? And it could be like the React community. I mean, you got all these people contributing code to it, but you really want to know that you're getting, you know, the latest React library from the folks, the core maintainers of React. And so trademark is one area that you can use to protect it. If people were to say, like, if somebody else wants to create a different kind of competitor, even if it's, you know, even in the open source world, there are incentives for creating competitors. And, you know, the React team, I mean, Facebook obviously has a pretty good legal team who could help protect that. There's other trademarks, pretty complicated. Actually, it's more complicated than you would think. And there are even things like trade dress. So the way that Docker consistently uses certain colors or the way the website looks might be protectable. I don't really know. I just literally just took a CLE on trade dress, I know it applies to products and packaging, but I don't know if that extends to like, say, websites or the packaging of like your, say like your node, your NPM repositories, right? That would be an interesting question. The other one that's very important and probably in some ways could be the most important thing that you might want to protect if you have a software company or you've kind of come up with an innovative way of doing stuff is a trade secret law, right? So the folks that came up with the Agile methods and the Agile manifesto and published all that stuff, if they had all worked for one company and had come up with this way of doing Agile software, and instead of exposing it to the world as they did, had kept it secret, you know, and had this one company that was able to produce results very, very fast, but they kept the method of doing that secret and the company took a lot of efforts to make sure it stayed secret, that could have been trade secret. It could have been protected by trade secret law, which I said is a state law issue. So the famous example of it that they always use is Coca-Cola. Everybody knows what's inside Coke, but nobody really know. Well, I mean, nobody's supposed to know how it actually gets made. So that way it's a trade secret. So that way, like, I mean, Pepsi tastes a little different than Coke. Maybe it's part of the ingredients, but maybe it's also partly the way it's made. Like I said, trade secret comes from state law. So they all have their own implementations. However, they're almost all the same. So they all follow something called the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. Not everyone does. I can't remember who does and who doesn't. But those are the big four: patents, copyrights, trademarks, and trade secrets. Think of IP law as like a huge bundle of sticks that you can carry around with you and pull out the right, or your attorneys can pull out the right stick when you need it to do some certain thing. So kind of a dry recitation of it. We'll get into more interesting, more nuanced areas as time goes on, but, you know, over the weeks, we'll try to hit a bunch of stuff, things like employment law, for software developers, right? Lots of questions there. Contract law. We can dive into details like open source licenses. And the big one that we should probably talk about for the next few soon is the new California Privacy Protection Act in 2018, which is kind of similar in its, you know, seismic shift to the GDPR, and it's coming to California. It's already on the books in California. It's going to be effective, I believe it's January 1 of 2020. So that's going to be a very, very big deal for software engineers. So lots of different issues, but I should pause there. Do you guys have any comments or questions about IP law or whether this is helpful or not?
It's very helpful. Thank
cool.
you.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, IP law, I mean, we can go into like tons of detail on every single little thing, but cool. Well, like I said, we have, there is a meetup coming, an in-person meetup coming to Torrance. I just kind of picked the kind of like restaurant bar where we could hang out, and it'd be pretty quiet. It's down in Torrance. We did our first one the week before in Santa Monica, but we'll do some more, maybe every 2 or 3 or 4 weeks we'll do a live happy hour, but we'll continue to do these calls too, so you can dial in. And if you have anything you want to cover or like an interesting news tidbit or a scoop you want to talk about, definitely shoot it to me via Meetup. Or you can email me at michael.rice@sidewalklegal.com. So it's like sidewalk legal, just one word. And I'll definitely try to touch on it. So thanks guys for joining, and see you next week. So that was it. Our very first meetup was in the books and now memorialized on the internet forever. Remember to sign up for the email list while it's still free at engineeringcouncil.substack.com. And also drop me a line if you want to join the weekly conference call. Wednesdays at noontime, I'll send you the Zoom link via email, or you could even RSVP via the meetup group if you want to join that. It doesn't really matter where you are. Anyway, can't wait to talk to you on a future call, and I'll see you on another podcast one of these days.